To introduce our first speaker of the day is Dr. Aaron Ritter. He will be giving us an introduction to Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Ritter is originally from Northern Colorado. His medical training and academic career has focused on the intersection of neurology and psychiatry. He's completed training primarily at institutions focused on this, including a medical school at the University of Colorado, residency and internship at the University of Arizona, and a fellowship in behavioral neurology and neuropsychiatry at the Cleveland Clinic Lurubo Center for Brain Health. He's been a clinical staff here at the Cleveland Clinic since 2016, and he's been heavily involved in the clinical trials program. His research interests include clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease, atypical neurodegenerative syndromes, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And now, here's Dr. Ritter.
Well, thank you for that introduction. It's a pleasure today to speak to you about Alzheimer's disease. I have the opportunity for 15 minutes to give you an introduction to this disease. I think the most important thing for me to talk about today is how things have evolved over the past couple years and how we think about Alzheimer's disease. We've made a lot of discoveries scientifically about how we think about this disease, and I'm going to share with you what I think is the most important, and that is Alzheimer's disease is a disease continuum. So the history of Alzheimer's disease goes back at this point about 100 years now, when it was first described in an individual with young onset Alzheimer's disease. And we were only able to diagnose the disease based on a brain biopsy, autopsy, post-mortem. And so the goal of diagnosis at that point and throughout the recent history was about ruling out other causes of cognitive decline. And so that has changed over the past several decades into the point where we have a pretty good understanding of the symptomatic phases of Alzheimer's disease. This is the FAST stage that is well known and been described for about 20 years. And under this paradigm, we would diagnose Alzheimer's disease based on several different stages, seven stages, four which are symptomatic. And we would sort of think of Alzheimer's disease as a disease entity. Either you have it or you don't. What we've learned over the past two decades as we've sort of come to this molecular understanding of Alzheimer's disease is a disease as a continuum. So the area that I have circled is a period of asymptomatic disease. So we know now that Alzheimer's disease is a disease that starts many years before the onset of symptoms. And the current research understanding is that's at probably 15 years before we start to see symptoms. But we still see this as a disease period. It also is a window for opportunity to treat and potentially have a disease-modifying effect. But now we realize that the disease starts before the symptoms and then progresses in a characteristic pattern, but not the same for each individual. So I think the best way to think of Alzheimer's disease as a biological and clinical continuum covering both the preclinical stage, which tends to be a period of time where we see the buildup of amyloid protein in the brain, and then a symptomatic period where we start to see the effects of neurodegeneration as tau builds up. So what do we think of as a continuum? A continuum is a seamless sequence in which adjacent elements are not perceptibly different from each other, although the extremes are distinct. So what I mean by that is a dementia stage is much different than a preclinical stage, but that dividing line between the two is not well delineated. But what we're seeing is the buildup of biological substrate that effectively knocks out the ability of neurons to function effectively, and that is sort of a buildup in sort of the sigmoidal shape. But we see this as a disease continuum, so all the dividing lines between the different stages are not clear, and we see that clinically as we see patients. And so the disease is different for each individual. So again, we talk about a preclinical phase followed by an MCI phase and a dementia phase, where we see a lot of overlap between these different phases. And it's a distinct departure from normal aging. So this is kind of how we think about Alzheimer's disease. Rather than a distinct entity, we think about patients being along a disease continuum that are moderated by these neurophysiological substrates. So I think the important part to start with is sort of this asymptomatic preclinical period. So this is the stage of the disease where we start to see evidence of biomarker change. And then that's followed by these two stages where we see symptomatic followed by a dementia stage. The pathophysiology, I think at this point is pretty clear, is related to amyloid. Amyloid in Alzheimer's disease is the first change we see in the brain. I know there's been some question about what the role of amyloid in Alzheimer's disease. It's pretty clear based on genetic mutations, including the presenilin 1 and 2, and with our experience with Down syndrome patients, that the accumulation of amyloid is that first step. And when we see this as evidence of a buildup that eventually will lead to downstream effects. What is really interesting, and I think has been borne out from both the biomarker evidence and autopsy data, is amyloid alone seems insufficient to cause symptoms. So the accumulation of amyloid in the brain likely triggers some other downstream event, because the association between amyloid and clinical symptoms is not as strong as other factors that affect the disease. So I think the most important biological substrate in terms of symptomatic symptoms is tau. And tau is sort of the degradation of tau within the neurons. Tau is a scaffolding protein that holds the neuron together and facilitates transport along the axon. And in Alzheimer's disease, what we see is the degradation and disintegration of tau to the point where the neurons themselves shrivel up into these neurofibrillary tangles, and this correlates very closely with cognitive symptoms. Now, we know that there are other processes likely impacting this pathophysiologic process, and those include mitochondrial, metabolic, inflammatory, other neuronal processes and changes in myelin and things of that nature. So this is a complicated dance between amyloid and tau, but these seem to be the consistent findings in our diseases. So the three key pathophysiologic processes are amyloid accumulation into neuritic plaques. This happens many years before the onset of symptoms, followed by the formation of neurofibrillary tangles, which is the degeneration of the cytoskeleton, and then that leads to neurodegeneration or progressive loss of neurons and their processes. So research criteria now suggest an ATN framework based on the presence or absence of three biochemical processes, including amyloid, tau, and neurodegeneration. So each patient can be characterized whether or not the presence or absence of amyloid, the presence or absence of tau, and the presence or absence of neurodegeneration. And so this is how we characterize patients in a research paradigm in Alzheimer's disease. An important factor, and I think which we're really working on, and I think this will be the next generation of Alzheimer's disease therapies, is preventing the transition from the normal aging process to the preclinical stage of Alzheimer's disease. When does amyloid start to accumulate? It's likely influenced by several factors, including genetic and environmental. Things like ApoE seem to play a role in when that happens in an individual's life. Cardiovascular factors, diet, physical exercise, and cognitive engagement all seem to impact when we start to see the accumulation of amyloid in the brain. Cognitive reserve, this is really important. Cognitive reserve is the concept of the ability of the brain to engage in sort of alternate brain networks and cognitive strategies to cope with the effects of pathology. So we know that certain people may have certain levels of pathology and not be affected. And so cognitive reserve is that term for the sort of ability of the brain to cope with pathology. And so it's likely influenced by physical activity, cardiovascular factors, and cognitive engagement. So this is a thing that protects us from the effects of the pathology we see in the brain. So it's important, as even as young individuals, that we build up that cognitive reserve. So education, healthy lifestyle, exercise, these are the things that bolster our cognitive reserve and allow us to fend off the effects of amyloid pathology. And we know some people that die with a lot of Alzheimer's disease pathology in their brain never develop symptoms, and that is likely a product of their cognitive reserve. Another important stage is the transition from the preclinical to the clinical stage of disease. I mentioned this before. It seems to be not just amyloid itself, but tau plays a key role, leading to neurodegeneration. And so then we have several symptomatic stages that are really well known and have been previously characterized, but again, is the result of the buildup of this pathology in the brain. Disease progression. Right now, all of the biomarkers are diagnostic. None of them are predictive or prognostic. The best marker of prognosis is related to memory function. We know people with episodic memory impairments, the inability to do tasks of recall, are more likely to progress from MCI to dementia. We also know executive function is important in those individuals that will progress from mild cognitive impairment to dementia. Language tends to follow executive function decline. And so we can track patients both clinically and then functionally. But right now, memory testing seems to have the best prognosis in terms of people that have the biomarker evidence of disease. We're increasingly looking at these biomarkers to inform this ATN framework we've talked about in research. And so things like amyloid PET scans and tau PET scans have become clinically available. They're still not covered by insurance, so they're not done very often. CSF testing, FDG PET, which measures neurodegeneration. So these are all the tools we have in our tool bag once patients are symptomatic that we can use to diagnose them, but they're not prognostic markers. And we do not have recommendations to get this testing in people that don't have symptoms. So these biomarkers are not suitable for testing in people with preclinical disease. So people with family history, it's not recommended to get amyloid PET scans or tau PET scans at this point. So I think from a perspective of a cognitive disorder specialist, I think the important features of doing a diagnostic workup are to get a history from both the patient and a well-known caregiver or an informant who can provide some information, because people often don't remember that they don't remember. We often supplement that with a functional and cognitive assessment, and then we favor things that test episodic memory. So right now, in terms of we want to marriage the biomarkers with the clinical symptoms to sort of place people on this continuum. So in summary, we now have evidence to suggest that Alzheimer's disease is not just a disease entity, it's a disease that follows a continuum that has both biomarker features as well as clinical features. The biomarker assessments are important for the diagnostic capacity in symptomatic individuals, but they provide limited prognostic information. And I think the future of Alzheimer's disease, this gives us hope, because there are several windows of activity where we can intervene that may slow down the progression of the disease or delay the onset of clinical symptoms. So I think the future will see personalized approaches that take into consideration comorbidities, cognitive reserve, and early detection of when amyloid builds up in the brain. And so I think the important takeaway from this introduction is to think about Alzheimer's disease as a disease continuum that we have an evolving knowledge around the pathophysiologic processes along with the clinical syndrome and specific areas where there can be intervention.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ritter. That was a really great presentation. We do have one insightful question. The question is ASL available clinically?
I'm sorry, ASO?
ASL.
So that's primarily a imaging modality that's used mostly in a research paradigm, arterial spin labeling of the way in which blood moves through the brain. And those sequences are not helpful at this point on an individual level. So it's primarily studied on group levels. And then once we're able to get to the point where it means something individually, then it will be available clinically. But right now, that the primary use is research-based.
Okay. Anybody else have a question for Dr. Ritter? If you don't catch him now, you'll be able to catch him later on this afternoon. So here we go. Does COVID exposure influence progression, Dr. Ritter?
That's a great question. I think for a number of factors, these are multifaceted, complicated disease. Our brain is influenced by our genetics, our biology, and also our psychosocial environment. So we've seen in our clinic the social isolation that comes from COVID, the sort of depression and things that come from not being able to do the things we normally are looking forward to, that definitely has a impact on our progression. Biologically, I think the question is, does COVID cause a progression of the biology of Alzheimer's disease? We have no evidence of that now, but it hasn't been well studied. So I think we'll know more in the coming months to years. But I think from a psychosocial perspective, absolutely, COVID could have an impact on how a person's brain works. And so more research is going to be done. But in general, we don't think that COVID necessarily enters the brain in most individuals. So I think biologically we'll be able to answer that question as more research accrues. But right now we don't have clear evidence of a biological acceleration of COVID, of Alzheimer's in COVID.
Okay. The next question is, does cognitive reserve really slow progression of AD, or does reserve just cover up symptoms?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is probably the research to this point would indicate it probably covers up the symptoms. And that's why we see a more rapid progression in some individuals who the disease was sort of delayed. And at some point you reach a biological threshold where people aren't able to compensate. So a lot of times people with high cognitive reserve tend to have an acceleration of the disease in later stages. So I think the answer to that question would be more likely the second part of that, which is there's a covering of symptoms, but at some point the ability of the brain's functional networks to overcome become overwhelmed, and then the progression could be faster.
All right, great, thank you. We've got to move on to the next presentation, but Dr. Ritter will answer these questions in the chat box. And we will also cover early onset AD and some of these other issues in presentations later on this afternoon. But all of your questions will be answered, I promise. So thank you, Dr. Ritter, and we will see you soon.